I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire, National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Yes, Lee, how are you?
Senator Carroll, just fine, thank you. Welcome to our city.
Since the assassination, six of these people have died in some kind of an accident.
There is no evidence of a conspiracy.
These people were killed. And whoever killed them is going to try to kill me. Austin thinks that maybe we all saw something up there.
There will be no questions.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners, on this edition of the program. The 1970s saw a genre of cinema known as the paranoid political thriller come into vogue. The aftermath of the political assassinations of the 1960s, which included the violent deaths of prominent public figures like Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, Senator Robert F. Kennedy, and, of course, President John F. Kennedy, combined with the tumult of the Vietnam War, the presidency of Richard Nixon, the saga of Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers, and the scandal of the Watergate break-in, created the perfect storm for this genre's rise to prominence. Such films as 3 Days of the Condor, The Conversation, and All the President's Men reflected a cultural shift in which Americans were beginning to question their political system and where it was headed in the 1970s under the Nixon administration. It was within this time period and context that Alan J. Pakula made what some consider the ultimate conspiracy thriller, 1974's The Parallax View. Following the exploits of a reporter who, after the fatal shooting of a presidential candidate, stumbles upon a vast conspiracy involving a shadowy corporation in the business of recruiting assassins for highly valued political hit jobs. The Parallax View is more than a film about paranoia. Simply put, it is also itself paranoid and asks the question, what if our worst fears about the American political system, namely that it is too corrupt to be reformed, are true? And moreover, what if we can become its unwitting pawns? Although the Parallax View does make many veiled references to the assassinations of the 1960s, particularly the RFK and JFK assassinations, its characters and events are ones that spring from the fictional imagination of its makers, and is more than just about political assassinations and the conspiracy theories that arise in their aftermath. It is a film that meditates on the chaos and fear that followed from the end of the 1960s, and, I would argue, has an emotional resonance today in these politically turbulent and paranoid times. Although the Parallax View upon its initial release received mixed reviews, it has since been recognized as a classic of its kind, as evidenced by its receiving a coveted Criterion Collection treatment on Blu-ray this year. Joining us to reflect on the significance of this 1974 thriller are three different guests: film historian Joseph McBride, filmmaker Alex Cox, and John Borsten, who, as it turns out, served as an intern and assistant to director Alan J. Pakula on the film. First up, Joseph McBride joins us for a conversation that dives deep into this film and some of the politics that were occurring in America when it was made. Joseph is both a noted film historian who has worked on biographies of Frank Capra, Orson Welles, and Steven Spielberg, as well as authoring a book on the deaths of JFK and Officer J.D. Tippit, entitled Into the Nightmare. With all that being said, let's get right to the conversation with Joseph McBride for the first part of our Parallax Views on the Parallax View retrospective. Welcome back to Parallax Views, Joseph McBride, to talk about the movie that this show takes its title from, The Parallax View. How are you doing, Joseph McBride?
Good to be with you again. And yeah, it's perfect for you. Good title, good podcast, good movie, right?
Definitely. I would say it's a masterpiece, and it just got a Criterion Collection release on Blu-ray. I want to get into maybe the plot of this film, because it's about a journalist that comes across this conspiratorial organization, the Parallax Corporation, that is recruiting assassins, and he sort of gets enmeshed in the conspiracy. What would you add to that maybe summary of the plot?
Yeah, well, it's a kind of Kafkaesque tale of this guy who is trying to investigate this mysterious organization. He winds up being the patsy and the fall guy in an assassination. And you can see that they took elements from the story of Oswald and the JFK case, as well as the RFK assassination. The opening assassination of a presidential candidate is quite similar in some ways to the RFK shooting. It takes place in a restaurant, and it's there's a waiter who looks like the assassin, but it's actually another waiter in the shadows. You know, that's similar to what happened with RFK. There were Sirhan didn't shoot Robert Kennedy; he shot other people, but the fatal shots were fired from behind, probably by the security guard Thane Eugene Caesar, who was right behind RFK, and fell to the floor with him when he was shot. And Robert Kennedy pulled off his Caesar's tie, and you can see that in the photograph. But the coroner did a good autopsy, Noguchi, and said the fatal shot was fired from contact range, which means almost touching his skin. And Sirhan was never more than 3 or 4 feet away. But the plot trajectory shows Beatty infiltrating this group, and they're on to him. I just watched it again, and when you see it repeatedly, you can see that these guys are, you know, they figure him out pretty fast. He's a guy with some problems. He's an intrepid journalist, like in the 70s, but he makes some big mistakes.
If I could comment on that really quickly, one thing that's really interesting about this film that I've talked about with the other guests on this edition of the program, this retrospective about the Parallax View, is that the Warren Beatty character, Joseph Frady, this journalist who's trying to crack open the conspiracy of the Parallax Corporation, he actually has the same sort of sense of ruthless ambition that the corporation looks for in their assassins. And in a way, I wonder if they were almost from the beginning trying to recruit him as a patsy because he had the same ruthless ambition as those assassins they recruit.
Well, I think that their basic part of their mission is to recruit patsies, you know, and they have professional killers to do the actual hit work, but they're looking for patsies. There's a brilliant sequence in the middle of the film where he watches a training video, which is to screen and find people who have violent tendencies. And it's like an indoctrination propaganda video, really a powerful thing. And he also does a psychological test that's supposed to find people with violent traits, antisocial traits. It's sort of the cliche of the loner, semi-psychotic killer, which we're so fond of in America. They're looking for guys like that that they can pin the crime on. And if you look at a lot of assassinations, that is the pattern, you know, like Aquino in the Philippines, he got off the airplane. Mrs. Marcos warned him in the New York Times a month or two before, if you come back to the Philippines, you probably get killed. And he's getting off the plane and he gets shot by some of their government agents. And then there was a hapless airport employee on the tarmac and they just shot him. Blamed it on him and they got away with it. Although President Marcos lost power as a result because the public saw through that. But I mean, that's typical of a lot of assassinations to try to eliminate the patsy right away, which is what happens in Parallax View.
I think another interesting aspect of the film that I wanted to get into is it starts out almost immediately with the introduction of a character, Lee Carter, played by Paula Prentice, and I almost got the impression, oh, she's going to be the main character in this movie, and I feel like the movie deliberately pulls the rug out from under you with regards to what happens to her, I think, 10 minutes into the film.
Yeah, you know, I just thought, I hadn't thought of this before, it's sort of like Janet Leigh in Psycho. You kind of think it's going to be about her, and then she suddenly gets killed, and it's a great moment in Parallax View, you know, we're giving away a lot of the plot, but she does a wonderful scene where she comes to Beatty and says, somebody's trying to kill me, and he doesn't believe her because she has her own problems, and it's really well acted, and she's really desperate, and then he scoffs at her, and then there's a jump cut. You see her lying dead on a slab in the morgue, and then he realizes that this is a serious plot, and then he has to convince his boss, a very good performance by Hume Cronin, Pakula, Alan Pakula, the director, did a seminar with the American Film Institute. He said that he modeled Cronin's character on Maxwell Perkins, the famous book editor who edited Hemingway and Fitzgerald and Thomas Wolfe and other people. And Scott Berg had done a really good biography of Perkins. And he was known as a very kind of benign but firm editor who could improve people's manuscripts, although there's some controversy about did he really improve Thomas Wolfe or not. But anyway, he's a really interesting character and a very literate man. And so Hume Cronin is a very likable, erudite, but skeptical guy who he's not stupid or naive, but he's scolding Joe Frady. I think it was Robin Wood said Frady, it's like pun on Freddy Cat. It's like, you know, he's a Freddy Cat. But actually, he's a very bold, intrepid reporter, like a lot of the young guys were in the, you know, he's maybe imitating Woodward and Bernstein or something, charging around, getting in trouble. I mean, they were a little more restrained than this guy is. He gets in trouble. And the editor has to literally bail him out of jail and things like this. And so he's kind of warning him. He likes him, but he's wary of his intrepid, reckless qualities. And so Beatty has to really convince him that he's onto something. And then he believes it. And he's kind of his only confidant and enabler. And that's a really good relationship in the film.
In regards to some of the approaches that the film takes to really tell the story and also to develop this sense of paranoia and mystery, when we mention, for instance, the Lee Carter character, we don't really see what happens to her. There's a lot of unanswered questions. And also with the Joseph Frady character, we're often seeing these sort of pulled away shots, shots from far away of him that give the impression that he's being watched. Could you comment on that aspect of the film?
Yeah, one thing that really, really was striking about Pakula's work, he's a really fine director with Clute, which preceded this, and other films that he made. But this one is very striking visually. Gordon Willis is a great cinematographer, had a lot to do with it. But Pakula shot a lot of it with long lenses, you know, which create this subconscious feeling of surveillance, as you say, that it flattens people out and you see them from a distance. And he also does a lot of just wide shots. He doesn't have a lot of close-ups. He uses the close-ups sparingly when they really count, like when you see Lee Carter dead. But it flattens people out too against the landscape and makes them seem small against these giant, interesting architectural sites. And I think that's part of the Kafkaesque feeling you get from the film. And the cutting is very interesting too. It's very unusual. The way one scene cuts into another is often unexpected, and the compositions are off kilter and everything. And I saw an interview where it was said that Pakula wanted a comic book look to it. And I think he was looking for a sort of a pop art quality, which the film has, very bright colors, which kind of, you know, it deals with the American political scene. The political candidates you see are kind of shallow, cartoony types. It never specifies much about their politics. You know, it's all kind of vague political rhetoric. And maybe they were trying to be evasive about identifying them. Like, no, there's nobody who's as clear and radical as Robert Kennedy in the film. But I think it shows a pervasive skepticism about politics in that period, 1974. American films were in a period, a very good period, where they could make serious adult films that they can't make anymore very much in the studios. But the audience was ready for unhappy endings and downbeat stories and stories exposing corruption.
I was going to add to that. I mean, this is the period of Bonnie and Clyde, another Warren Beatty movie, Easy Rider. There was a very different approach, I think, arriving on the scene of cinema than what we saw with old Hollywood in a lot of ways.
Yeah, from, you know, the studio system was collapsing from the mid-60s onward. And so there was a period from the late 60s until Star Wars, which basically ruined everything. You know, I remember I went to the first screening of Star Wars at the Academy Theater, and I felt afterwards, it's over. I mean, the kind of movies that I loved were not going to be made anymore, basically. And the Reagan era was approaching, and once that came in, everything descended into juvenilia. And I was trying to make political films. I was a screenwriter back then. I was trying to get political subjects made and couldn't get anywhere with, I had a wonderful project, a biopic of Fidel Castro. Can you imagine going around trying to sell that in the early 80s? And people looked at me like I was some crazy radical. And it was actually a very funny, terrific idea, but they wouldn't listen to it. And I wanted to make a movie about the Bay of Pigs invasion. I actually had three projects that dealt with Cuba, you know, which is a hot button issue even today. And so I was trying to sell these things, and Hollywood didn't want to hear about, they didn't even want to hear about adult stories. They wanted to hear about kids stories. You know, I got Rock and Roll High School made. I was one of the writers, and that turned out really well. And that's a very political film, actually. I was the one who kind of politicized this story, which originally was going to be just about kids goofing around in high school, and I turned it into a political allegory, and they blew up the school at the end. And you couldn't make that film today. It's too radical for today. But it was ignored at the time because it was just a B movie, you know. It was a grim period. But in the early 70s, you know, that was the same year of Godfather 2 and The Conversation, you know, 1974 when The Parallax View came out. We were kind of spoiled. We didn't realize how lucky we were. Chinatown, you know, I was looking at the release schedule every week or two or every month, there'd be some amazing, great film coming on. We kind of took it for granted. There was a lot of garbage coming out too. And I reviewed a lot of the garbage on Variety. I was a second string critic, so I got to see a lot of the schlock, but there were some really brilliant films made in that period. And people were ready for downbeat endings and serious things, which they don't want anymore, really.
With regards to the Parallax View, did you see it when it initially came out all those years back in the 70s? Could you talk about what your initial thoughts were on it? Because I know there were these sort of mixed reviews coming out. I think the New York Times sort of gave it a bad review. Why do you think it got these mixed reviews?
I was reading about some of those reviews. They're kind of bizarre. I mean, I didn't read those at the time, but, you know, the media in America, the mainstream media don't like to deal with the Kennedy assassination or the RFK assassination. And they're against so-called conspiracy theories, which is an all-purpose dirty word. Today, it means almost anything, you know, and it's the term is now used. I mean, it's all over the place now because of Trump. And yeah, there is some deranged conspiracy theories like the QAnon thing and the idea that Trump won the election in a landslide, et cetera. But they're all kind of thrown together by the media into one big hodgepodge, which is partly intentional because it confuses people about things that actually were conspiracies. I mean, everybody agrees Watergate was a conspiracy. It's unavoidable. But what kind of a conspiracy was Watergate? I think it was very different from the idea that the public has about it. And it's worth us talking about a little because Pakula made All the President's Men. And he got the job to make that film because the Parallax View, Robert Redford had seen the Parallax View and thought, oh, this is the guy I want to direct All the President's Men. And there are a lot of visual and thematic similarities between those films. But the media were not hospitable to films that said America's political system and judicial system was deeply corrupt. And the way that Parallax View frames itself between two of these government commissions lying to the public, you know, that appealed to a lot of the viewers, but not to some of the people in the mainstream outlets like the New York Times.
So in regards to your experience when you first saw the film, what were your initial impressions of it when you saw it all those years back?
Well, you know, I was very struck by the visuals. Pakula was unusual, and Willis had a profound effect on the look of American films. And he shot the Godfather films and The Conversation. And Bill Butler shot The Conversation, I'm sorry. But Willis shot some Woody Allen films like Annie Hall, et cetera, and Manhattan. And he did things that were unusual. He'd have like, you know, flat perspectives, a room that looked very flat because it was shot from far away. And people would leave the frame and then come back in and the camera wouldn't go with them. You know, that was unusual at the time. And it's interesting. It creates an eerie feeling in Parallax View. You're always wondering what's on the outside of the frame and what's going to happen. And the film is full of unexpected events. I think one flaw that's fairly obvious is some of the scenes are kind of ludicrous in the early part of the film. Some of the action scenes they put in, a big fight scene in a bar that gets pretty silly. And there's a scene where they almost get drowned in a river and other fight scenes. It's kind of loaded with that in the early part of the film. I preferred the scenes of serious political chicanery that go on. But I think they felt to sell this film to the public, they needed some of those action things. And, you know, it's also, I was reading up on it. This film was shot during a writer's strike and they went into it without a finished script, and Pakula and whoever else were throwing together the script as they were shooting. And I guess Robert Towne did a rewrite Lorenzo Semple Jr. and David Giler get the credit. It's based on a novel by Lawrence Singer, which deals with the JFK assassination, but this was turned into fictional assassinations. But it has a kind of stitched together quality, if you could look at it in retrospect. Even the editing, what makes it interesting is the kind of unexpected cuts and things, but maybe some of that came from the chaotic shooting schedule, but they made it work. I was struck by the eerie visuals and the strong allegorical quality that it has about, sometimes a film is better when it's not based on some particular event, but it's kind of an allegorical tale, like a Kafka story about a ordinary guy who gets involved in something bigger than himself, and then he winds up being the victim. And it also has a lot of Manchurian Candidate feeling. That's a kind of a prototype of these kind of films. It's a really great film, but that was 1962, and that's very eerie and surreal. And it has some similarities, such as the ending when the programmed assassin is up in the, the rafters of Madison Square Garden, and at the end of this film, Beatty is up in the rafters. And it also looks like the Trade Mart in Dallas, where Kennedy was going to speak when he was shot. I'm sure that was done intentionally.
I wanted to add to that real quick. That sort of climax in the rafters, maybe I'm reading into it too much, but the imagery and the architecture he's around, you almost get the sense that it's like a symbolic... The imagery gives a sense that he's become enmeshed in this sort of geography of conspiracy in a very physical sense as well. Yeah.
It's very much like imprisonment or enmeshment. Orson Welles's The Trial, which is based on Kafka, has that look as well. They shot that in an abandoned train station. And the ending, one thing that makes that ending good in the Parallax View is that it's not a big crowd scene. It's a lot of empty tables and seats and some people rehearsing, a band and a marching band and a couple of people. And then you hear the candidate giving a pre-recorded speech, which is bizarre, as he's driving around in a little golf cart. It's very strange. But the emptiness of the place really works for the film. It makes the guy's speech seem even more hollow, that you're listening to this canned speech as he's driving around, and it keeps going after he's shot too. But it's very spooky, and he's like a rat trapped in a maze, Warren Beatty's character, and he's not going to get out of it. But there are all kinds of allusions to Oswald's fate. And in that sequence I mentioned of the training film, there are a couple of shots of Oswald getting shot, the famous shot of him reacting in pain when he gets shot. And but he was similar to that. He was an agent, I believe, of the FBI who was infiltrating the plot against Kennedy and reporting. I mean, in my book, Into the Nightmare, My Search for the Killers of President John F. Kennedy and Officer J.D. Tippit, I found out that Oswald had reported to the FBI at least three times in November. For example, the day he was killed, the Dallas Morning News, that morning before he got killed, the morning papers said Oswald had met with the FBI as recently as November 16th, and that fact has kind of been forgotten. And the FBI admitted that he came into the office around November 12th, and there was another meeting. So he was reporting on the plot. He had infiltrated the plot. He was a patriotic American who thought he was serving his country and trying to protect Kennedy. And he may have infiltrated. Kennedy was supposed to be killed in Chicago on November 2nd. And there was a tipster named Lee who tipped them off about a hit squad that was following them. And the Chicago police and the Secret Service actually arrested some people, and Kennedy's trip was called off at the last minute, so Oswald may have saved his life. But then he winds up finding out that he's the fall guy. And he didn't know that probably until Kennedy was shot. Oliver Stone's JFK does a good job of showing that as it dawns on him and he walks outside and he realizes, oh my God, I'm the fall guy in this plot. And that's what happens in this film. That's why it's so similar to that story.
I was going to ask, since you mentioned Oliver Stone's JFK, and also there was another film released either before the Parallax View or maybe around the same time called Executive Action.
It was right before 73, the year before, yeah.
What sets the Parallax View maybe apart from those films? What are its main differences?
Well, executive action is very specific to the Kennedy assassination. It's kind of like, in a way, a rough sketch for JFK, although much less sophisticated and sort of a low-budget film. But it had some very good actors, Burt Lancaster, Robert Ryan, et cetera. And it's kind of it's sort of a showing how the plot might have gone down. You know, it focuses on the perpetrators, the guys planning it and the guys who carry it out. It's pretty good, but it's sort of crude in some ways. But JFK is a highly sophisticated, very complex, you know, visually stunning film, a very powerful film. And, you know, I mean, the irony about JFK in the media, got viciously attacked. And the media basically said this film is just a big lie and it's fabrication and blah, blah, blah. I mean, the irony was the lie was the cover story that they helped create with the Warren report. You know, and JFK, in my opinion, is very factual film. You know, I would disagree with a few things in the film, and we've learned more about certain things since the film was made. But if Stone put out a annotated screenplay, he made a mistake. He said he should have had it out the day the film opened so people could see where all the things came from. But the annotated screenplay will tell you all the sources, and they made some composites and things, but it's a very accurate film, I think, about what probably happened. And it leaves out certain things, but it's a brilliant film. But Parallax View is a more abstract film, and it's an allegory, and it's not meant to be specific to RFK or JFK, but it brings up a lot of images and memories for you.
In regards to the Parallax View, I also felt like it's getting at something more than just political assassinations, especially when watching the test sequence. I feel like it's almost a commentary on this sense of decline in American values, or a sense of despair about where America was headed at the time. The test sequence images, that montage, it starts out with all these sort of nice all-Americana images, and then it gets really dark. The images of Oswald and Ruby and the KKK. Do you think there's a lot more going on than just an examination of the assassination in that sequence and the broader film as a whole?
Yeah, that sequence really deals with America and American mythology. As you say, it starts with kind of Norman Rockwell, sort of nice images of God and mother and country and father and all this. And then it starts to get darker and darker and more violent. And then it goes back to the nice images. I was seeing this interview with John Boorstin where he said, you know, if you could put it in words, you wouldn't have had to make that 3.5 minute film. It's impossible in a way to say exactly what everything means in that film, but it's a tremendous it's a satire of propaganda films at the same time as it is a kind of an example of a propaganda film. And one of the things that's really a good directorial thing is that they don't cut to cutaways of Warren Beatty, so we're watching it as if we're him, and so it puts us in his shoes. And I mean, it deals a lot with the kind of unseen powers that we feel control our lives, that, you know, Peter Dale Scott called the deep state, which is the term that Trump took over, and it kind of corrupted the term. But the feeling that, you know, there's a kind of external system that we think we're governed by, the elected officials, and then there's kind of a, you know, the CIA, FBI, or whatever, behind the scenes doing things that we're not privy to, and we don't find out about for 5 or 10 or 20 years or whatever. And that was really, you know, the Kennedy assassination in 1963 was a huge change in our way of thinking of the country, because we were very naive and trusting of our government pretty much back. I remember in 1960 when Eisenhower was caught lying about the U-2 plane, we were all shocked the president would lie to us. And now we're shocked when the president tells the truth. I said that the other day on a show, and somebody said, well, okay, now we have Biden, he's pretty truthful. Okay, right. But, you know, Trump lied all the time. If he got caught telling the truth, it was a big shock. But we're you know, the Kennedy assassination started us on this road of not trusting the government, which in some ways is healthy, in some ways is not healthy, and it leads to this pervasive distrust right now that the election was fair in 2020, and you know, who invaded the Capitol, et cetera. You know, the people try to lie about these things, and there's a divide, and everybody talks about this. We live in two alternate realities because people don't know what to believe anymore. And it's partly because our belief system was shattered by the Kennedy assassination. And a lot of people thought it started with Vietnam, but it really started with the JFK killing. And then Vietnam made it worse, and then Watergate, and, you know, all kinds of things happened after that.
Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers.
Yeah, the Pentagon Papers showed us, I mean, but, you know, they came out, and that was very revealing. We learned all kinds of things about the Vietnam War that we hadn't known before, and it was in government documents. Some of them are disputed. People argue about, you know, for example, JFK was trying to pull out of Vietnam, and there is documentation on that. And then Johnson reversed his policy 2 days after the assassination secretly. And you can prove that, but people don't want to believe that because it's sinister, you know. And the JFK film revolves around that thesis that Kennedy was killed because he was trying to end the war in Vietnam. And but a lot of people today just refuse to believe that, for example, even though there's documentation. So there's all kinds of disputes about the meaning of events, even though we have documents, and millions of pages of documents have come out on the JFK case. But some are still withheld, and people have said, you know, why are they withholding documents on this murder that happened 57 years ago? If a lone nut with no motive did it, what is the national security reason for withholding some documents? That's crazy, isn't it?
I want to talk a little bit about the director of the Parallax View, but first, one thing that really struck me about the film, after watching it, I said, this is almost like the political thriller equivalent to a horror movie. It's a political horror movie in a lot of ways. Yeah. And that beginning with that Warren Commission style committee, and then it ends with another Warren Commission style committee. It's almost like a nightmare. It's like a cyclical nightmare that you can't get out of. That seems to be the point of the film. And it's really horrific and terrifying.
And the way he shoots it is wonderful. It's, you know, this dark void, and you see in the background these guys sitting at this dais, you know, and the camera moves in very slowly, and then at the end it pulls away. It's very creepy to have that blackness surrounding it. And then they pop off. If you notice at the end of the film, they give their verdict, and then all the guys disappear, which is kind of a eerie thing. It is like a horror film. It's a thriller. You know, one thing I'll take dispute with is people – called these paranoid thrillers. That's the term you always read. And they say this,
especially for movies like The Conversation, The Parallax View, The President's Men. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a whole, you know, 3 Days of the Condor. There's a whole bunch of films in that period that are good films, but I don't think that they're paranoid. I think they're actually accurate. You know, there's that famous quote from William S. Burroughs who says the paranoid is somebody who knows a little of what's going on. You know, these are films that are getting into really truths about how society works. And people like to label that paranoid because it's a clinical term that means you're disconnected from reality, which is insulting to people who are dissidents. You know, if you have a dissident view, it doesn't mean you're crazy. But that's part of what they try to do, is to make dissidents look like they're nuts. And so you run into that a lot if you're a JFK assassination researcher. I went through decades of, you know, you try to talk about it to people and their eyes would glaze over. They wouldn't talk about it, or they would insult you or whatever. I'd say it's getting better in some ways because the younger generation, like my students, they will listen to you when you talk about it. They don't have those preconceptions that people my age did.
I wanted to add something to that really quickly, if I could. I think what's interesting about the Parallax View is it looks at the political turbulence of the time and the sense that, you know, maybe we, the citizens, aren't in control of this vast system. Mm-hmm. And it reacts to that with horror. Whereas now I see a lot of younger people are almost so cynical about governance that they just think, Kennedy was, you know, killed by a conspiracy. They got to Epstein and there's nothing we can do about it. And that this is just the way the world is. There's almost an apathy now opposed to a sense of horror.
Well, that's one of the really disturbing things that's happened, and that was done on purpose. There's a really good book called History Will Not Absolve Us by Martin Schatz. He's a psychiatrist, and he analyzes. I always was bothered by the fact that, you know, consistently 60 or 70% of the public doesn't believe in the Warren Report but they don't do anything about it. You know, why is that? But he answers that question. And he says that to go from belief to action is a big step that most people are not willing or able to take. They don't know what to do. And it's really hard to take action. I mean, the action I take is I write books and I teach and, you know, I do what I can, or some people make films or some people take political action. But we all feel kind of helpless to some extent that you can't stop these things from happening. And I think young people have been living with that their whole lives. I mean, I still remember the time when we thought, you know, government could do something for us. Maybe, it still can to some extent, but we're more aware of all the things that are, like the Electoral College and the Congress, can't get anything done hardly in Congress because it's gridlock, you know, I mean, that's a problem. The whole idea of apathy, as Schatz points out, he said, the public was conditioned to find the Kennedy assassination acceptable. It was acceptable to the establishment. That's a very disturbing thought, that they thought, okay, well, he got killed, it's sad, but okay, that's, what can we do about it? It's okay, you know. I mean, they actually accepted it. The media and the government accepted the president's brains were blown out on a public street. And then, sure, it'll happen again and again and again. And, you know, we have these wars, like I was one of the 10 million people in the world marching against the war in Iraq, but we knew that it wouldn't stop that war from happening, and the war was pointless and killed hundreds of thousands of people. And we're still fighting in Afghanistan, and we can't seem to get out of there because every time somebody tries to pull out, Biden or even Trump, people push back. They won't let them pull out. You know, I mean, and the public is more liberal than the political class too. But it doesn't matter to most people that 60 or 70% of the public thinks that Kennedy was killed by a conspiracy. It matters to the average person, but they think, what can you do about it, you know? And young people are very interested in hearing about this, which is at least a good step, is you want to learn about it, you have an open mind. I think that's something.
Now, you also told me when we were setting this interview up that you actually knew the director, Pakula. Could you talk a little bit about your experiences with him? Did you ever get to pick his brain about this specific movie?
Not exactly. I don't think I had lunch with him one time. I remember a very nice lunch. He was a very erudite, very kind, civilized guy, very sophisticated man, very charming, smart man, excellent director, but just a really good person. And I interviewed him a few times, and I'll tell you a couple of interesting stories that are revealing about All the President's Men, for example. When that was shooting, I wanted to interview him. I think I was on Variety at the time. We were doing a series of short profiles of hot directors, and I think I was going to do one on him. And some publicist set up an interview. I was supposed to go to Pakula's house in Beverly Hills at noon on a Saturday while he was shooting, you know. So I show up at the house and ring the doorbell, and he answers, and he was obviously frazzled with work. And he said, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "Well, you know, your publicist said we have an appointment." He said, "I can't talk to you. I'm sorry, really, you know, I'm making a film right now, and I don't have time." So I thought I had time for one question. And I had a friend who was a researcher of the Robert Kennedy assassination, which not too many people had gotten into at that point, but she and some other people were really into it. And she was telling me things about it. And one thing she told me, she said, Bob Woodward was CIA. And here is Pakula making All the President's Men, which is valorizing Woodward and Bernstein. And she was wrong. He wasn't CIA. He's ONI, Office of Naval Intelligence. He's an ONI agent. I mean, once an ONI agent, probably always. But he started that way. He was in the Navy intelligence, and he was on a ship in Vietnam doing intelligence work. And then when he came back to Washington, he had the job of briefing Alexander Haig at the White House, Nixon's chief of staff, every day on top secret naval intelligence. And he denies that today, but it's been proven. And so he was an agent working to undermine Nixon. And so we found out, if you read the book Silent Coup and Secret Agenda, I won't go into a lot of detail, but Watergate was really a CIA plot to bring down Nixon, who was embroiled in a battle with the CIA for power. And there's a scene in Oliver Stone's Nixon, which conveys that really well. It's not in the release version, but it's in the director's cut, where he goes to see Richard Helms, the head of the CIA, and has a really tense meeting with him. It's a brilliant scene. But they're in this power struggle, and the CIA wanted to get rid of him. So what they did was, Nixon didn't know about the Watergate break-ins, but they set it up. These were CIA people who set up these break-ins, and then they figured Nixon would commit crimes to cover it up, which he did. So they entrapped him and basically engineered his resignation. It was a form of getting rid of a president without shooting him. And so anyway, Woodward was, but I said to Pakula, I said, have you heard the story that Woodward maybe is CIA? And he said a very revealing thing. He said, yeah, I've heard that, but you know, since I'm directing this film, I can't think about that or I would go crazy. I thought that was a wonderful comment because, you know, he's sophisticated enough to know that maybe there's more to it than the, you know, the hero reporter thing that these two guys wrote, but I can't think about it. That reveals a limitation in Pakula, perhaps, you know, if you're a commercial director. I would love to see a real film about Watergate. I guess you could say Oliver Stone's Nixon does a good job of that, actually. I mean, that is a real film about Watergate, but it's about other things too. But but you could remake All the President's Men and tell the truth, is what I mean. But Pakula didn't do that. He created a mythic fairy tale, which is a really well-made film, you know, really gripping. But, you know, Deep Throat didn't exist. There was no Deep Throat in the original manuscript of that book. And Alice Mayhew, their agent in New York, suggested they add a character who's the secret source who meets them in garages and stuff. And that was all fictional. And what that character is a composite of all the intelligence sources that were guiding and leaking to Woodward that he didn't want to admit to, you know. And so then they claimed later it's this guy, Mark Felt, you know, which he was probably one of their sources, but there was no one guy called Deep Throat. But, you know, we've been fed this mythic story of Watergate too. And
which I was going to say, that's not to say that like Nixon was some great guy necessarily either. No. Yeah.
No, he was a crook too. But I mean, he was a complex man. He's one of the most interesting figures in 20th century American politics. He and FDR, I mean, really, Nixon had great talents. You know, he's a real tragic figure because the tragedy is about somebody with great talents who destroys himself. And that's what Stone's Nixon does, which I think is a great film. And I gave it a great review for Box Office Magazine. But he was crooked and he was mixed up with the mob and, you know, and he did all kinds of criminal activities. And when you read Haldeman's diaries, it's very disturbing. Mostly what they talked about in the Oval Office was how to screw their enemies. And they made anti-Semitic remarks all the time. It's very disturbing when you read those. And then when you hear the Watergate tapes too. I mean, he was an unsavory guy and he was drunk a lot. I was very nervous during that period because every night I thought, Jesus, the president's probably getting drunk and he might nuke some country. He would call up Kissinger at like midnight and say, nuke some country or other. One time he called him up and said, nuke Capitol Hill. Not thinking that if he knew Capitol Hill, he would be destroyed. Kissinger, we owe him that much credit. He's a horrible guy too, but he said I would just disregard it. And then at 7:30 or 8 o'clock the next morning, Nixon would sail into the Oval Office and he would have totally forgotten, like alcoholics do, that the night before he had said nuke so-and-so, you know. But anyway, no, Nixon was he's not as bad as Donald Trump. And Nixon did a few good things too. I mean, he opened up China to us and he created the EPA and, you know, he had a lot of talents, but unfortunately he went off to the dark side, as Lucas would say. But the other Pakula story I was going to tell you, oh yeah, I was walking through the editing building at Warner Brothers when they were editing. I guess they were still shooting. No, they were shooting All the President's Men. That's right. And it was one night, late at night, and I was walking through and I heard some dialogue. It sounded like Robert Redford and Dustin Hoffman. So I peeked in the back and they were watching rushes from All the President's Men. And Robert Redford was sitting there with Pakula right toward the front all by themselves. And I watched a whole scene, 10 takes, the scene where the two reporters intimidate a woman reporter, if you remember this, she's had a sexual relationship with one of Nixon's aides and she's broken it off and they want her to go back and come on to the guys so she can get some documents for them. It's an unsavory thing these two guys are doing to this woman, and she's not happy about it, but she agrees to do it. And the 10 takes were fascinating because they're all different. The two actors were the same lines, but they were doing it with a different tone each time. The two guys and the woman was pretty consistent, you know. But anyway, I watched it. It was fascinating. And then I snuck out. And then later, I think it was at the same time I went to Pakula's house. You know, I said, I have to tell you, I snuck in. I watched some of the rushes. And I described that whole scene to him, just like I did to you. And he had a big smile on his face. And he said, oh, I'll tell Bob. He'll go crazy. I love that because Redford is super private, you know. The idea that a Variety reporter was watching the rushes, Pakula thought that was very mischievously funny. He was going to tell Redford, you know.
So, since we're talking about All the President's Men a little bit, of course, for people that don't know, the Parallax View is sort of the middle part of what's become known as the Paranoia Trilogy. So it starts with Clute, and then the Parallax View, and finally All the President's Men. I feel like there's something very interesting when you look at the Parallax View compared to All the President's Men. I often wonder if for Pakula, All the President's Men represents maybe his hopes for the possibility of reform and for journalism to act as the fourth estate. And then the Parallax View represents maybe his worst fears about a system that can't be reformed.
That's a really good point, isn't it? Because the guy is the reporter in Parallax View and he gets killed for trying to get a story that's a legitimate story. That's what's phony about All the President's Men. The idea that the Washington Post is going to save the country by telling the truth is such bullshit. You know, the Washington Post is a very conservative. It's the idea that the Post is a liberal paper is one of the great myths of American journalism. They're a CIA front and they were for a long time. Phil Graham, their former publisher, was involved in Operation Mockingbird with Frank Wisner of the CIA. They were recruiting reporters to work for the CIA. And now it's open because Jeff Bezos does business with the CIA. It's their current owner and it's no secret. And so they're just a kind of propaganda organ. The idea that they're going to solve our problems is naive and silly.
I was going to add to that really quickly. I actually had Jefferson Morley on a few months back, and we were talking about his time at the Washington Post trying to get the story of Gary Webb out, and he had trouble doing that. So I guess that tells the story right there.
Yeah, there's a good movie, Kill the Messenger, about Gary Webb, which is a terrific film. But, the only good American films, occasionally is a big mainstream film that's okay, but usually the cheaper the film, the better. Like Nomadland is an excellent film, but it was made as outside the system, relatively low budget. But Kill the Messenger was made cheaply, and it's a terrific film. Didn't get shown a lot, but it got made. That's a scandalous story. Gary Webb uncovered the CIA's drug running with the Contras, which wasn't even a secret, but he got a lot of details on it. And then his own paper abandoned him, and the Washington Post and the Los Angeles Times wrote a disgusting attack on him. And the media turned on him. And then the CIA's own inspector general did a report on this, and it basically said he was correct, that they were trafficking crack to aid the Contras, and Oliver North was involved in this. And the media lied about it, you know, and the guy allegedly killed himself. We don't know. I mean, maybe he didn't kill himself, but that was a terrible tale of a reporter destroyed for trying to tell the truth.
And of course, we see the parallels between that and what happens in the Parallax View. Before we wrap up, I just had maybe two more questions. The first one, I know that you have a film class. Have you ever shown the Parallax View, and did you ever have students have reactions to it?
Well, I teach sometimes a class called Film and Society, where I show different kinds of films on social issues, and I do it as a kind of a history class because the students generally don't know much about history at all. Like, I'll show All the President's Men, and I'll tell them, you know, this is a well-made film, but don't believe it at face value, and then let's talk about what really happened, and then maybe do a paper and try to find out what's true and what's not. You know, I challenge them to find out about history. Or I'll show Point of Order, for example. I'm showing that in a class tomorrow, about the Army McCarthy hearings, which is a really good film, and, you know, to educate them. But they don't know about Joe McCarthy and the Army McCarthy hearings. You have to, this is a way of telling them about these subjects, you know. And but I, with the Parallax view, what I have shown a lot is that sequence of the training film. And we talk about that. It's a good thing to show because it's kind of self-contained and you can discuss it. You know, I talk a lot about propaganda, you know, how propaganda affects you. And it's very important. I teach students to recognize the effects of propaganda on their lives and not to believe in any one news source. You know, like, don't get all your news from the San Francisco Chronicle or the Washington Post or the or CNN or Fox or whatever. You know, read 10 newspapers a day. Watch as many reports you can, and do your own research in books and documents, and listen to podcasts like yours. And, you know, you have to be a critical consumer of the news to understand things. And so I talk a lot about how the propaganda works on you. And a lot of propaganda comes from the mainstream. They like to sell the idea that propaganda exists on the internet and all that. And yeah, there is a lot of that on the internet, but there is an awful lot that New York Times is a propaganda organ, as is the Washington Post and some other entities.
Well, the legacy media, I think, especially in places like D.C., they're so tied into these institutions now. They're not going to question them. I mean, in a way.
Somebody said the media are the propaganda arm of the military industrial complex. Jonathan Rosenbaum, the film critic, has a good phrase: the media industrial complex. You know, they're all part of the same racket. And the Washington Post, for example, since we're talking about Pakula and everything, I mean, they exist to prop up Washington, institutions. And the institutions turned against Nixon and expelled him. And then previously the institutions turned against Johnson and expelled him. And Kennedy, Indira Gandhi said of the Kennedy assassination, probably the best thing ever said about it. She said, Kennedy died because he lost the support of his peers. That's really disturbing. Then she got killed too, But these media outlets are there to prop up. They think of themselves as part of the same system. And my parents were journalists back in the day when journalists didn't make a lot of money. They were kind of working class people. Now these people make a lot of money and they hobnob in the same social groups. And they kind of think of themselves as we, you know. I always get suspicious when they say we invaded Afghanistan or we're going into Iraq. Or, I mean, who are these we? There should be they. They should be critical of people. But, you know, you lose access. Access is so important in journalism. If you start criticizing things, you won't get called on at a press conference, and then the paper will take you off the beat and you lose your job and you wind up back in Iowa or someplace.
I wanted to add to that because it just popped up in my head. Do you think that Hollywood has sort of become part of that in some ways? I'm recalling, for instance, one of your friends, I believe, Joe Dante, has talked about how on one of his films, I believe it was one of his early B movies, Piranha, they tried to get the military sort of involved with it because there was a subplot involving the military. And he said that they would try to sort of mold and shape the film. And of course, we do know the Pentagon when they're involved in film production.
You should interview David Robb, who's a really good investigative reporter in Hollywood. He wrote a whole book on that, how they have the military and CIA have offices in Hollywood that'll help you make a film. And they insist on changing the script but they supply you a lot of hardware and ships and all kinds of stuff, and it's very cost effective. So they really have a lot of control. I mean, direct control. And Dave goes into really specific cases. Joe told me a funny story about his film, Small Soldiers, which is a very good satire of toys, war toys, and has kind of that links with our bellicose foreign policy. He said Burger King had the final cut on that film. Can you believe this? They had made a tie-in deal with Burger King, so they actually had final cut on his film. I mean, this is how crazy it gets sometimes when you talk about commercialism. And let me just say one more thing about Parallax View that nobody else has said. I just want to throw this in because my favorite Western is Shane. I just love George Stevens as Shane.
And with Jack Palance, right?
Yeah, Jack Palance. Alan Ladd starred in, Jean Arthur, my favorite actress, and Van Heflin. Pakula was a big fan of Shane, and there's a documentary about George Stevens Jr. about his father, and Pakula's in it, and he says he worked at Paramount at the time, and they were all worried about Shane being expensive. And somebody said an Alan Ladd film has never made more than 1.5 million or something. And he said, but this wasn't an Alan Ladd film. It was a George Stevens film. I thought that was great. But anyway, in the I just noticed something last night. This is why I want to bring this up. In the training video, there are two shots of Alan Ladd and Shane, which I found wonderful. He's a father figure. It says father. And he's a mythic father, iconic figure. And it shows him with his hand on the arm of the little boy, you know, he's in there, and he's what we all kind of wish a father figure would be, but he's a tragic character. But I noticed, I always wondered why they had that gratuitous saloon fight in Parallax View, which seems kind of ridiculous. Warren Beatty walks into this bar and he's got long hair and these rednecks are kind of making fun of him. Well, that's
it,
a homage.
Like something out of those old
Roger Moore. It's a direct homage to Shane, though, because Shane goes into the saloon when it's next to the general store and he orders soda pop because the little boy wants soda pop. So he says, I'll have the soda pop. And then you have Ben Johnson and some guys sitting there who are tough guys and they're, oh, soda pop. And they're making fun of him for being effeminate. And Ben Johnson goes over to him and says, oh, I'm going to make you a drink of your whiskey and be a man, you know? So he does a homage to that. Warren Beatty goes up and he orders milk and they make fun of him. And this guy comes up and says, I want you to have a drink. And then Warren Beatty says, well, you know, I can't, I'm a girl. I mean, it's funny dialogue, you know? And then they have this big fight and Beatty triumphs. And that's why he put that in there. And Stevens shot a great saloon fight in Shane. But you know, it's kind of out of place and it's cartoony and in a way that I think hurts the Parallax View, but it's because he loves Shane. So I just thought I'd throw that in.
I didn't even catch that was a homage to Shane, but now it all makes sense.
Yeah.
In closing here, and then I promise to let you go because I kept you a little bit over time. After all these years, the Parallax View has gotten this great Criterion release. I think it's been accepted as really a classic thriller of the political variant. Why is it you think that this film has had so much staying power and now is really considered part of the pantheon of truly great cinema that has come from America?
Well, it's a good sign that film aficionados are more sophisticated than some of the reviewers were at the time. I was reading some of those quotes, as you mentioned, they were making fun of the film as being implausible or absurd, but we know it's not absurd. We've learned a lot maybe since 1974. Some of us have learned a lot since 1963, but it takes other people longer to learn about these things. But if you have an open mind and you read books on the history of our country, you know, when you think about it, all the major events in American history since 1960, and I won't go through them all, but they're all based, the official stories are all lies. They're all absurd. You know, if you recount the official stories, they don't make any sense at all. So what's really going on in American history? So I think we've kind of come to realize this, and we've just lived through 4 years with this completely mendacious president who's trying to destroy our democracy. And so it forces people to realize that a coup d'etat, you know, the Kennedy assassination was a coup d'etat, but we used to say that to people and they'd look at you like, we don't have those in America, but we just had an attempted coup. And the Washington Post has been trying to deny that. They started calling it an insurrection, then they downgraded it to a riot recently, as did other media. And now next it'll be like a tailgate party that got out of control, I think is what they're going to call it. But they don't like to admit that we have things like coups and dictators in our country, but we do. And I think people have come to realize that maybe it's created a climate in which we could accept that genre again. But it was a popular genre at the time. I think Parallax View got somewhat eclipsed by some of the other great films that were coming out at the time. Maybe that was part of the problem. And it's not a perfect film, but there's also a moment in the film where Warren Beatty sort of exonerates the FBI and the CIA. Did you notice that? Where he says, well, you know, I can't say who they were involved. He's telling his editor, or maybe some fringe people in there. That's kind of a fallback position in the media. Sometimes they'll say, well, it wasn't the organizations. It was a few bad apples. And that's kind of a cop-out. And they probably threw that in as a disclaimer. Paramount probably told them to put that in. So there are some things that are not perfect, but I mean, how many films are perfect, you know? But it's one of the films that really helps illuminate our system and our helps us understand our way of life and the political system in which we are enmeshed, like you use that good word to describe the Beatty character at the end.
I was just going to add, as a side note to that, I think that it's interesting. The Parallax Corporation, I think you can project any number of things onto that politically. You know, some people say, oh, it was the CIA that did it in Kennedy, or it was the mob, or it was, you know, some people even think it was Castro and the Russians, right? And more right-wing side of things thinks that. And I think you can sort of project whatever you want on the Parallax Corporation in the way – in a way that you couldn't if you just said the FBI or the CIA. So maybe that's very deliberate.
Actually, you know, one thing we've learned over the years is they have these mercenary private security firms, which like Blackwater, which I guess was renamed I guess it was called.
Right, Eric Prince.
Yeah, I mean, you know, sinister. We outsource a lot of our assassinations and fighting because we don't have a draft anymore. So, you know, it's an all-volunteer army, but we hire a lot of mercenaries, and they're not even open about how many people they're hiring. And they get paid more than the average soldier, too, which is wrong. They get exorbitant amounts of money, and they go over in foreign countries and just, you know, operate with impunity. At least in the military, there's a code of military justice that they're supposed to follow. But these mercenaries and private security firms operate in a shadowy realm, and that's it wasn't exactly unheard of in 74, but it's become more and more visible in the years since then. That's maybe one reason why this film doesn't seem as far-fetched. And in a way, it does take the CIA and the FBI off the hook because it's a private firm, but you know, you could easily extrapolate that they're working you know, they're doing dirty work for the CIA or something. But it's the film is, you know, it can only go so far in 1974. It couldn't connect all the dots. Executive Action tried to connect some of the dots. Even that pulled a few punches. JFK didn't pull punches, and it got viciously attacked, you know. But it's the public loved JFK, and they all went to see it. But this film helped lead to JFK and Nixon. Nixon is a great film, too. I'd recommend that to people. And that got and only... Nixon grossed only $8 million in the U.S., and it kind of hurt Oliver Stone. He can't make political films anymore in Hollywood. He had films he wanted to make, like the Martin Luther King assassination, Bush and Noriega, My Lai Massacre. They wouldn't let him make any of those films. It's really a loss, and it's partly because Nixon failed at the box office. JFK was a big hit, partly because people said, people love JFK and they didn't like Richard Nixon, you know, but it's a sexier story or it's more exciting. Whereas Nixon is a very, you know, more it's a cerebral, complex, very complex. Well, not that JFK is not, but you don't get to see these kind of films anymore, like Parallax View very much. Maybe some independent films do it, like Kill the Messenger. But, you know, maybe that's one reason they're popular on home video is that we're starved for that kind of film.
And I would say that we've been robbed of a lot of great Oliver Stone movies because the mainstream always goes after him for JFK. But regardless what you think of the Kennedy assassination, movies like Salvador or even what he wrote with Scarface. And yeah. I know Scarface is kind of a pop art type movie and people consider it trashy, but there is it's a good message.
It's an interesting allegorical film, too. I think Salvador is a terrific film. But, you know, what he does to compensate for not being able to make his big Hollywood political films, he makes documentaries. Like, he made two on Castro, and he made other ones, too. And they're interesting and independent, low-budget documentaries. To me, that's where the action is in films, is low-budget. And the documentary field is thriving. You know, a lot of good subjects that aren't treated in Hollywood films or even on the news media, like the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, were kind of ignored mostly by Hollywood because people didn't want to go see them and the studios didn't want to make them. But there are a lot of good documentaries on that subject. Errol Morris makes excellent documentaries on political subjects, you know. And so if you want to see political subjects, that's the place to look now, is the documentary field.
Well, I want to thank you again, Joseph McBride, for staying a little bit over time and having an in-depth conversation. Anything else you wanted to add? No, and thank you again.
Well, thank you very much. I just got to say, this is my Kennedy poster from when I worked as a volunteer on his campaign in Wisconsin in 1960. And then I got a Robert Kennedy poster. I didn't work on his campaign, but he was the campaign manager in Wisconsin when I was working for JFK, and I saw him at a rally. The film Primary is a terrific film. I'm an extra in Primary. There are 3,000 people in the big rally scene when Kennedy comes in, and that's when politics and show business merged, which has had good effects and bad effects. But so I have an original Robert Kennedy poster there as well, and they mean a lot to me. And you know, John F. Kennedy inspired me a great deal, and his death, I wanted to be a politician, and I lost faith in our democratic system when he got killed, and the crime was not solved, and the wrong man was arrested and lynched, and so I decided to become a writer instead. So that's why that happened.
Well, thank you again.
Thank you,
McBride, for coming on Parallax Views.
Thank you. It's always, your shows are very important, and this is a way to get the truth out outside of the mainstream media, and I think that's very important today.
Well, that does it for the first part of our Parallax Views on the Parallax View retrospective. I'd like to thank Joseph McBride for coming back on the show for a long-form discussion about this classic 70s thriller. Next up, Alex Cox, the filmmaker behind such features as Repo Man, Straight to Hell, Sid and Nancy, and Walker, joins us to discuss the Parallax View further. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@ProtonMail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Zach, Omar, Ted, Gratz, Martin, Gary, Amelia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15, doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.